Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
This legislation is for those that we've tragically lost, and it is for those who are surviving or who have survived.
South Australia is the third jurisdiction to pass coercive control laws. Legislation will take effect in 2027, aimed at combating horrific impacts of often unseen abuse. Also, it's been 6 years since the devastating Black Summer bushfires raged across Australia. And as another hot summer looms, experts are urging communities to be bushfire prepared. And later...
Whilst we have treatments that are looking at how, you know, we manage a cancer diagnosis, for me it's about, well, what does that mean for the person? What does it mean for their family? And what does it mean for their everyday life?
Today, a new campaign kicks off in support of nurses caring for patients with cancer. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, the Albanese government has announced a new target aiming to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 62 to 70% by 2035, a similar target to meet the world's collective target of net zero by 2050. The pledge has received mixed reactions, with climate advocates across the country outraged at the figure, while industry experts reflect on what implementation could mean across different sectors. Program manager for Climate and Energy at the Australian Conservation Foundation, Gavin McFashion, says the target is extremely disappointing, with figures falling short of what is needed.
There is no scientific basis for this target. The science that says if we want Australia and the world to live within a safe climate range, and that's an average of 1.5 degrees average temperature rise, this will get us nowhere close to that. This target locks in more extreme, more frequent extreme weather across the country, like the floods we've seen in Taree and Lismore, like the algal bloom that people are suffering through in South Australia, like the droughts we're seeing across Southern Australia. We haven't seen anything yet compared to what's coming, and due in no small part to the lack of ambition that sits within this target range of 62 to 70%. So it's an extremely disappointing target announcement and reflects that the government is still more committed to the future of the coal and gas industry than it is to the livelihoods of average Australians already feeling the effects of climate change.
And what's the required target, in your opinion, that would actually make a difference?
Well, the science says we actually need to be at net zero by 2035, but we know that was extremely difficult to reach. The Australian Conservation Foundation was pushing for a target of 80%. That was within breathing distance of keeping us within reach of a 1.5 degree world, and we could have probably lived with a 75% target. So for the government to shoot this low, 62% at the bottom end of the range, is really a devastating announcement for anyone concerned about climate change, for people who just only a few months ago elected the Albanese government thinking they were going to take climate change seriously. Any of those people and those who have experienced climate-fueled disasters in recent years should all feel abandoned by this government with this announcement.
I can see that many climate advocates across the country have expressed disappointment, but what would be the consequences if the government doesn't even immediately act on these targets?
Well, the government has a current target of 43% by 2030. So these are all on 2005 levels. And I know sometimes the targets can be quite confusing to people. That does keep us on a direct trajectory for net zero by 2050, but it makes too much of the heavy lifting on emissions reduction to those later years. So if anything, we should be front-ending the ambition, not leaving it to the 2040s to do the heavy lift. This is a government with a significant majority, and we think that it should have showed far more courage and bravery than this timid response.
Since May 2022, the Australian government has approved, from my understanding, 31 new and expanded coal, oil and gas projects. What would this kind of trajectory in mind, what would this say about reaching these emissions reductions?
Yes, well, it approved the largest gas project just last Friday, the North West Shelf Project in Northwest WA, the biggest gas project in the Southern Hemisphere out to 2070, which does, again, bring into serious question whether this government is serious about achieving net zero by 2050. The scientific community, the International Energy Agency, all the climate experts say that we have to stop approving coal and gas projects, not sometime off into the future, but right now, if we're to have any chance of keeping within safe climate. And what we fear is that with this timid target, that it allows the government to continue to allow coal and gas projects to be approved, belching emissions into the atmosphere, either here or in the countries we sell our coal and gas to. And that's why this target looks like that the Albanese government is running a protection racket for the coal and gas industry rather than keeping Australians safe.
Can you offer any insight how the government intends to make any changes or in terms of policy and the like?
We're still digesting the announcement, obviously, but there has been a significant $5 billion injection into the National Reconstruction Fund. That's to help heavy industry get its emissions down. There's been a new injection into the Clean Energy Finance Corporation of $2 billion that will provide household assistance to further encourage people to take up solar, renewable energy, batteries, insulate their homes and so forth. And there's also been an announcement to increase the number of charging stations for EVs. We encourage people to put pressure on the Albanese government to call for an end to coal and gas exports and to replace them with a future made in Australia. And that's in renewable export industries like green steel and iron, hydrogen, critical minerals manufacturing, and direct renewable energy exports, so that we're transitioning not just our domestic economy, but we're transitioning our export industries as well.
Program Manager for Climate and Energy at the Australian Conservation Foundation, Gavin McFashion, speaking with me.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
This month, South Australia passed laws to criminalise coercive control as a standalone offence, making it the third Australian state to adopt this legislation. Coercive control is an underreported type of domestic violence where an abuser seeks to control a victim's behaviour. The state's laws are set to come into effect in 2027. Minister for Women and the Prevention of Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence, Katrine Hildyard, says the delay is to allow time to educate and train police, courts and other domestic violence workers. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Minister Hildyard to hear more.
In 99% of domestic violence homicides, coercive control was present in the relationship that preceded that horrific final act. The prevalence of coercive control and those tragic consequences absolutely demand that we act. Up until now, our law has recognised in the whole those incidents of physical violence, but hasn't appropriately recognised those terrible patterns of violence that are not always physical, but have a terrible debilitating effect on those who experience it.
Embolden is the peak body for specialist domestic, family and sexual violence services in South Australia. CEO Mary Leaker says, understanding coercive control and what it means is vital. She also points to important lessons to be learned from challenges in the rollout of the UK's coercive control legislation.
Coercive control is something that women experiencing domestic and family violence have been talking about for a really, really long time. But we're now starting to use the language of coercive control a lot more. So essentially, we can understand it as a pattern of abusive behaviour over time, which really has as its core intention the aim to control and constrain someone's autonomy and freedom of action and movement. Really, the person using coercive control achieves that through creating and maintaining an environment of fear. And one of the important things about coercive control is that it often does involve physical and sexual violence, but it doesn't necessarily always. So it's a pattern of abusive behaviour over time that's really about power and control.
The new coercive control legislation that's being implemented, what are your thoughts on the fact that it's taking 2 years to come into effect?
Embolden has always been supportive of the state government's intention to have a long lead-in time before the coercive control legislation comes into force. And one of the reasons that we support that is there's a risk that the legislation will let victim survivors down if we're not prepared as a state. And we know that from the experience internationally, so particularly in the United Kingdom.
What are some other challenges enforcing coercive control that, say, other states have had that have passed that law?
In Australia, these offences are relatively new. In speaking to the experience in the UK, certainly evidencing has been a challenge. It's just really important that at an operational level, police have the understanding and also the capacity to look at that circumstance in a more holistic way so that they are looking for patterns of abusive behaviour rather than, again, seeing domestic and family violence only in terms of potential physical violence and individual incidents of physical violence. One of the concerns that's been raised internationally is that with the criminalisation of coercive control, there's a heightened risk that the person who's experiencing coercive control will be misidentified as the person using abuse. And that's particularly a risk for culturally and linguistically diverse women internationally. But in the Australian context, there's a real concern. And Aboriginal advocates have raised the concern that this is particularly a risk for Aboriginal women. So one of the things that Embolden is very keen to see is that we have a really clear and transparent focus on when the laws come into force, whether they are in effect increasing the criminalisation of women who are actually victim survivors, not the person using coercive control. And as I said, we're particularly keen to ensure that that's not increasing the criminalisation of Aboriginal women.
Minister Hildyard again.
This legislation is so important. It is legislation for those that we've tragically lost, including precious Hannah Clark and her children. We were joined when this legislation progressed by Hannah Clark parents, Sue and Lloyd Clark, two of the most extraordinary people I have ever met and worked alongside as they mourn their daughter and their grandchildren. They have been incredibly brave in informing us about the need for this legislation, in speaking up and encouraging change. And I'm so grateful that they shared their experiences so courageously with us. And I'm very grateful to all of those survivors for providing us with so much incredible insight and direction as we took this legislation forward.
Minister for Women and the Prevention of Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence, Katrine Hildyard, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio. Today, a new campaign kicks off in support of nurses caring for patients with cancer. One in two Australians will be diagnosed with cancer at any point in time, facing different challenges before, during, and after treatment. The McGrath Foundation launched the Now for All Cancer Days to raise awareness about the Cancer Care Nurses Program available throughout Australia without any referral needed. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked Chief Nurse at the McGrath Foundation, Kerry Patford, the aim of today's event.
Today is our 20th anniversary of the McGrath Foundation forming. The original goal was to provide breast care nurses. In 2025, we achieved our goal of 250 breast care nurses, and now we've been given the opportunity to expand our care into people with all cancer, providing care for people with all types of cancer.
Fantastic. And now, could you please tell us a little bit more about the McGrath Cancer Care Nurses Program and what's the overall aim?
Yeah, sure. So we have 302 cancer care nurses in under the McGrath Foundation at the moment. 250 of those are breast care nurses or care for people with breast cancer. And we've just started placing nurses to care for people with any type of cancer. That's all throughout Australia. And that means that we are able to pick people up at the point of diagnosis and help them navigate and support them, provide information so that they can make informed decisions decisions about their health and their treatment right through a really rough time. I like to say we take the chaos out of a cancer diagnosis.
Now, with 1 in 2 Australians being diagnosed with cancer, to start with, that's a very scary number.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that means that someone's going to know someone that's been affected by a cancer diagnosis, or it could even be us. So it's great to know that we are taking steps to make sure that no one misses out on care.
So what's the impact from the Cancer Care Nurses Program to the patients?
For me, it's about that providing that consistent, holistic patient-centred care. So whilst we have treatments that are looking at how, you know, we manage a cancer diagnosis, for me it's about, well, what does that mean for the person? What does it mean for their family? And what does it mean for their everyday life? So it's about creating supports around the person that provide information, clinical care, expert knowledge and referral processes to put services in place to make a really rotten time as easy as it can be.
Having cancer, it's a very serious issue and it's a very delicate issue, but it's dealt better in metropolitan areas. How critical is to have this program across regional and rural areas across Australia?
Yeah, it's quite well known, unfortunately, that people that live in rural and remote areas have worse outcomes with cancer, and that's often due to access and availability of services. So creating services, cancer care services that are closer to home, so that means that people don't have to travel or shouldn't have to travel to receive cancer care nursing close to home.
The McGrath Foundation is fundraising to keep giving this support. What would more funding mean for the program and for the patients?
It would mean more nurses so that no one misses out on care. So that's great. That's our goal. We don't want anyone that has any type of cancer diagnosis to miss out on the support of a McGrath cancer care nurse.
And what other challenges the lack of nurses can develop?
Yeah, look, it's a well-known problem, and I think it's not just isolated to Australia. Of course, it's a worldwide problem that there will eventually be a shortage of nurses. But I guess by creating a brilliant workplace for nurses, we're attracting more nurses and hopefully, you know, inspiring people that are considering nursing as a profession to come into it.
And finally, Kerry, where can we get more information about the program and where can people go and donate?
They can go to the McGrath Foundation, www.mcgrathfoundation.com.au, and there is a link there that, you know, promotes them. So you go straight through to that one and you can donate. And IGA today doubling donations. So if you donate $20, we'll actually receive $40. Thank the Australian public and people like you for their support. We couldn't do this without the Australian public. So please know that it is gratefully accepted.
Kerry Patford from the McGrath Foundation, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. For more information about the cancer care nurses, go to our website at thewire.org.au.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
It's been 6 years since the 2019 to 2020 Black Summer bushfires raged across Australia. Amongst the blaze, fires destroyed thousands of homes, killed hundreds of people, left wildlife severely impacted and communities reeling. Recovery efforts have seen the best part of 3 years in some areas. But as another hot summer looms, experts are urging communities, particularly those in regional and rural areas, to be alert and prepared. To reflect on one of Australia's most catastrophic periods, The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with CEO of Parents for Climate, Nick Seton.
The impact has been so devastating. I mean, biodiversity is still recovering. And look, the reality is that with the government's, you know, National Climate Risk Assessment, we have a pretty frank assessment of what is coming down the chute on bushfire risk and the risk to health, well-being, lives and the economy. And that's something that the risk assessment that's been released this week has given a pretty clear assessment of the severity. And as a parent and for people who have kids, it can be quite confronting because the impacts to the people who are mentioned as numbers in that report are going to be felt by real people including potentially our own children. And they're going to be living with that increasing and escalating risk from bushfires and extreme heat events for the rest of their lives. It's something that I personally have grappled with, because when we were going through the Black Summer bushfires, my three-year-old at the time, he really struggled. He really struggled to breathe. He couldn't go outside. He couldn't play in the playground. And we couldn't really keep him safe. We didn't have a way of keeping the smoke out of our house or his childcare center. And we ended up rushing to hospital multiple times to deal with acute bronchiolitis, which was affecting his tiny and developing lungs. And that was something that we were experiencing in the suburbs, not near the flames. We didn't see fire. We just saw smoke. But we saw it through his eyes, and it was very confronting, and it was very, very scary to feel powerless in trying to keep your family safe.
Thank you so much for that, you know, confronting personal account. I think it takes a lot of bravery. With the major, you know, climate crisis that you mentioned as a risk factor, do you think Australians can now be seen as too complacent regarding bushfire protocol and preparedness?
I think it's fair to say Australia's not ready. But I think one of the realities is, with each extreme weather event and unnatural weather disaster that's hurting people, we're starting to realise that we don't have the preparedness, and we don't have the responsiveness that it takes to really keep people safe and look after people for the long journey afterwards.
In terms of other forms of preparedness, how can we share responsibility with our firefighting volunteers, as well as volunteer-built organisations such as Parents for Climate, in order to combat volunteer fatigue as well as build community strength?
Volunteering in response to this is so rewarding and so important, because we know through experiences like the Lismore floods and things like that, that it's actually local people that have the greatest impact in the first moments of these events and these disasters, and they can actually save lives. So yeah, if you can, there's volunteering opportunities in the local SES, in you know, the Rural Fire Service, and in local advocacy organisations like Parents for Climate, who are helping to really make sure the community's voice is being listened to on these important issues of adaptation and mitigation of pollution as well.
With summer just being around the corner, would you say that would be your main message to our community, or what other call to action would you want to broadcast when it comes to bushfire preparedness, particularly those who live rurally?
We're going to have to adjust, and I think it's a mindset shift that Australia, you know, very understandably, people don't want to make. Why would we want to have to deal with this you know, difficult consequence of pollution and global heating, when, you know, most people are, you know, living their lives as best they can, trying not to do any harm to the climate? But here we are, and this is just a reality we need to accept. And I think what's important is that Australians think not just about their own responsibility individually, keeping their property well maintained, making sure they're not accumulating excess fuel or fire risk. Ultimately, the big call to action I would put out there is that everybody has a preparation conversation, like what kind of things might be possible where they live, how do they connect with their community and emergency services, and how can they make sure that, you know, in the event that something, you know, really unfortunate does happen in their community, that they can be part of the solution and that they can be responding in a way that's keeping themselves safe and also making their community safer.
CEO of Parents for Climate, Nick Seton, speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show, brought to you from Mamina Shakur at 4EB in Melbourne. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.